Hello, everybody, and welcome to the extended free preview of this month's episode of What a Cartoon Movie, all about Corpse Bride. I'm one of your hosts, Bob Mackey, and there's a worm living in my head that sounds like a celebrity that's dead. I'll let you decide which one that is. Who is here with me today, as always?
Hey, it's a guy. I'm just going to drink this wine and start up this podcast. Henry Gilbert, hello.
No, don't. You've killed yourself and ruined the ending of Corpse Bride. Yes, folks, we're covering Tim Burton's Corpse Bride. That's the full name of the film. And this is a nice sequel podcast to our Nightmare Before Christmas podcast we did back in 2019. But yes, this time we're covering the spiritual sequel to Nightmare that is, you know, co-directed by Tim Burton, kind of. Music by Danny Elfman, that's okay. And all of the stop-motion sillies you expect. I should say stop-motion spookies in this kind of production. But yes, you're going to hear about 45 minutes to an hour of our history on Corpse Bride. If you want to hear the entire thing, including our three-hour movie discussion, head on over to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons and sign up at the $10 level. That will unlock the rest of this movie podcast, as well as almost five complete years of What a Cartoon Movie episodes, covering things like anime from, Miyazaki, Studio Ghibli, like Whisper of the Heart and Kiki's Delivery Service. We've done movies like Beavis and Butthead Do the Universe, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, lots of Disney Renaissance stuff, Pixar stuff, you name it. We probably have covered it in the past 5 years, nearly 60 movie podcasts, and you'll get to hear them all behind that Patreon paywall at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. And signing up for $10 a month also gets you access to that $5 stuff, doesn't it, Henry?
Yeah, Bob, that is very right. For $5 a month, folks, they get so many exclusive podcasts, over 150 of them. Each month, a brand new one of us covering King of the Hill and Futurama, and all of our previous episodes of that, too. Plus, you get us talking about every episode of The Critic, every episode of Mission Hill, and some of our favorite episodes of Batman the Animated Series. All that in addition to all of the $10 things if you go up to that premium level. So many podcasts at your fingertips at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons when you sign up today.
And if you've never signed up for Patreon before, it's so easy to do. And once you sign up, you're given a code. You just drop that into whatever you use to listen to podcasts, and that way you can download our bonus podcast alongside your free podcast as part of your podcasting lifestyle. And of course, Patreon has an app for any smart device you might have. You can download our bonus content that way as well. But no matter which way you do it, it's so easy to access all of the bonus podcasts waiting for you behind the paywall at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. That's it for this little upfront ad. Now get ready to hear us dig into the Corpse Bride. Let's talk about the history of Corpse Bride, though. We've given some movie opinions up front. Stay tuned for more of those, of course. But I want to start off by saying that, you know, this is technically a film made by the stop-motion studio Leica. And we covered them in depth in our November 2022 episode all about Paranorman, a movie that is great. Really, really good. If you missed our episode and or haven't seen Paranorman, please check it out during October. It's the perfect movie. And it's good on its own, but I wish I hadn't seen that before I watch Corpse Bride, because my standards raised a very, very high.
There's a third act twist in this that I'm like, oh, Paranorman did this way better. Like, of the...
Yes. Yeah. 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 No, actually, you mentioned it. So, like, the ending, the third act of this movie is Beetlejuice and Paranorman, although Paranorman came much later, but this movie ends with, like, a wedding where undead people are in attendance, and, it's very, very Beetlejuice, I feel.
And the Paranorman turn to it is like, oh, the zombies aren't as scary as you think they are. I could definitely see the people in Leica working on this movie then saying, like, man, we could do this way better. Keep this in our back pocket. After we adapt Coraline, then we're going to do the zombies are nice the right way.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk more about this soon on the podcast, but this is Leica's first real project after kicking out Will Vinton. And then a few years later, they'll do Coraline. So this is them not working with full creative control. They're basically guns for hire. They're stop motion animators, and they're working on, they're basically being told what to do, essentially. Mm-hmm. But they're the machinery of Corpse Bride.
Well, I mean, that makes sense because there really are only so many studios that can do this. Like Disney 10 years earlier, or more than 10 years earlier, they didn't have a stop motion division to hand Nightmare Before Christmas to. They basically just, Tim Burton said, give me the money. I'll hire Henry Selick and his friends in San Francisco who all worked on Gumby stuff. And then they'll make something stop motion because you don't have a stop motion studio. And Warner barely has an animation division in 2005, if at all. Like, so,
yeah.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, yeah, that folded in the late 90s, early aughts, the Warner Brothers animation.
Yeah, I mean, definitely they hired up for Looney Tunes Back in Action.
And right, that could have been it. Sorry, I totally forgot about Back in Action, the 2003.
Yeah, but then as we've talked many times about the Larry Doyle shorts that were supposed to be comboed with that, that got shut down. So I think that was like the next death of Warner Theatrical. Warner Theatrical just doesn't want to exist. Like, I think what's happened over time is that Warner Animation, all the good money and success got put onto direct-to-video. And so the direct-to-video got so big that eventually they could build up things on direct-to-video that could be showed in theaters if they so chose, like Teen Titans Go to the Movies.
Oh, right. That is them. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah. But let's talk about the story of Corpse Bride because it begins with a little guy we talked about last month named Joe Ramth, RIP. The movie is dedicated to him, obviously, we talked about. He passed away in 2005, and he was a great loss to the industry. But he was working on The Nightmare Before Christmas, and he was, you know, he was a story supervisor on that movie. He did storyboards for the movie. He was the voice of Igor, which says a few things in the movie. But during the production of this movie, he brought the classic Jewish folktale about the Corpse Bride to Tim Burton's attention because this is something that's obviously up his alley. And then almost a decade later, Joe Ramth ends up being the executive producer on this adaptation.
That's impressive that he's able to play both sides like that. You would have thought that Pixar and or Disney would have had him on an exclusive deal so he couldn't be working on, honestly, their competition for Warner on a Tim Burton movie.
Right, right. And I have a little bit about this original story. So it's a ghost story called The Finger, and it dates back to a compendium of Jewish folktales written in the 16th century. So this compendium is basically a series of parables that recount the adventures of this rabbi named Isaac Luria, who was a prominent Talmudic scholar who's often called the father of modern Kabbalah. So very important guy in the history of Judaism, which I know nothing about. So I'm taking this all at face value. But
this is Gentiles talking about Jewish history here. Yes.
Yes, absolutely. So here's what happens in the original story. So it's much like the movie, but it's about a rabbi. So this rabbi, he's goofing around in the woods. He's playing with a ring. He's just making up some vows, and he slips the ring on what he thinks is a tree branch because he's just playing around. And it turns out to be the arm of a dead woman who comes to life, and she's not like a totally hot goth babe. She's this terrifying specter of death, and she wants to consummate the marriage. And so I'll quote slash film summary of the rest of this very short story. Quote, Rabbi Luria eventually asserts control over his new bride. She retracts her request, and they take their unconventional marriage to the rabbinic court and ask for a ruling on a marriage between the living and the dead. The court sides with Rabbi Luria's argument that the marriage couldn't possibly be legitimate, and, wailing, the corpse bride collapses into a pile of bones. So, you can see, as my wife said, there's very little meat on this corpse bride.
It's basically a corpse misunderstands something, and then the rabbis say, no, this is what the Talmud says. You can't. Well, I mean, you shouldn't be able to marry a corpse. Like, I think that's pretty standard for most religions. You can't marry a dead person.
And because it's a parable, people have been interpreting the meaning of this. And I think the most common interpretation is marriage is what gives us life or something like that. It could be one of a number of things. It could also be like anti-necrophilia, who knows. But if you want to read this original short story, it's printed in full in a compilation titled Lilith's Cave, Jewish Tales of the Supernatural. We all know Lilith from Neon Genesis Evangelion.
Yeah, where the Lilum, who she's crucified to the Ray, of course. I would guess in that book it also tells the story of how Ray forms with Lilith and then, you know, causes third impact on the planet. That must be in there too, right?
I mean, I can get all the the Christian stuff, but when it comes to all the Jewish references that anime and video games have stolen, like Sephiroth, I'm up a tree. I don't know what's going on.
Well, because to them, it's all the same, you know, Old and New Testament, the same fun thing to take stuff from. And honestly, the Old Testament is full of more fun things than the New Testament.
It's got way more monsters in it. It rules.
You can make up more stuff because, it isn't all religion made up. But I mean, you can have, like you said, you can have more monsters. You can have more people who live forever. Like, if you have to set it in Jesus times or after, like, New Testament stuff, then you can't make up as much stuff about, like, well, we know that when Rome existed, there wasn't, like, a sea serpent or whatever, you know.
Records from this era aren't spotty.
Yeah, it's pretty well known. But yeah, I mean, I had heard a little about this, the roots of this, because didn't it become, like, a TikTok thing of somebody spreading around, like, whoa, Corpse Bride is based on something fucked up, man. Like, I thought I'd heard a little about that.
I mostly was reading reactions that were upset that they stripped out any Jewish elements, which I totally understand, because I guess the take was like, well, people don't want to see that. Yuck. They want a Victorian fairy tale. It's what they're expecting, but it's one of those things where it's like, well, we can't have a black Spider-Man. No one knows how to react to that. It's like, you have to at least try to put that in front of people and see what they think before you're like, well, they wouldn't like it because it's never happened before.
Yeah, no, I mean, now adapting this, you would never strip all of the cultural context out of it as you would then. I believe Joe Ranft is Jewish. I don't know about Tim Burton. I think he is. I definitely remember at least part of the alienation he felt growing up was that he was, you know, this dark-haired weirdo growing up in Burbank surrounded by, you know, beaches and blonde people.
But unfortunately, I think he was just a boring Protestant.
Oh, boo, man.
Yeah.
So, but I can see then why they stripped the Jewish background out of it then. I would hope they wouldn't do that now, but it's not they ripped out all, like, and put no culture back. It's just the culture they put back is the most boring British thing you ever could have, like the pure boredom of the English.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, they're applying this much whiter culture to this story in order to make fun of it, but I feel like this could have been more interesting if they had went with the Judaism angle. But, you know, like you said, Henry, I think they would have leaned more into that now. But back then it was like, oh, we want this to be more of a universal story for people. And when you think of fairy tales, you think of England and, you know, this era and everything. So that was their excuse. And I think it does, the non-Jewish version of this story fits more in with the Tim Burton brand, which is like, we're kind of doing Edward Gorey illustrations in the Land of the Living in this movie.
Yeah, I guess, too, it really fit with the style at the time for Burton. Like, Burton is not British, but he had a real British era, including, I would think, partially because he was married to a UK citizen, or no, not married, but he was
living in sin.
Yeah, but also living in a castle, I think, at the time, or soon would be in England. So he cast British people in so much of his stuff. He was in such a British era. Like, he does Charlie and the Chocolate Factory around the same time, an extremely, like, British film, also where Johnny Depp is the only, like, non-British person in the cast playing a less relatable weirdo in that one. So yeah, he was in a very British era.
And, you know, I did see some theories that Corpse Bride is based on a Russian folktale, but more people point to the Jewish folktale. But Burton says that he doesn't remember what the source was when Joe Ranft told it to him. And I think, honestly, they steal one plot point from this story, so they're not really adapting the story. They're like, what if this happened but in another story where everything is different?
Yeah, it's like you say something three times, and also like, yeah, you're right. The religious figure in this who, they're not even Christian. I mean, I guess it is a church, like, I guess it's sort of the Church of England bullshit in there, but Christopher Lee's character, who would be the rabbi or could take the rabbi role of authority, like in that fairy tale you just mentioned, that traditional religious story.
It's been folktale, fairy tale, you know, the supernatural elements, a very old story. I think it's fair.
Yeah, but anyway, Christopher Lee's character is not an authority in it. Like, Alfred's character, Michael Gambon, yeah, his character is kind of an authority, though.
I think you mean Michael Gow. Michael Gambon is...
Oh, I'm thinking of the other guy, yeah.
Is he one of the Harry Potters? one of those guys?
He was Dumbledore. And another things. But yeah. Look, he's another dusty old Brit, okay? I get him all confused.
We talked about Nightmare Before Christmas 4 years ago, and during that movie, Burton was very hands-off. It was basically, he had the original poem and the characters, and then Danny Elfman basically wrote an opera about himself, and then they filmed that in San Francisco while Tim Burton was filming Batman Returns in the UK.
Oh, and also Danny Elfman's then-girlfriend wrote in a script about how she's really taken for granted by Danny Elfman, too. Yeah.
She wrote in monster jokes and how she's being taken for granted by Danny Elfman. But on this one, he actually has a co-director credit to justify his name being in the title, which we remember that Henry Selick was very mad about his movie being called Tim Burton's. And I think most people who don't know a lot about animation are going to assume, oh yeah, Tim Burton directed that, because why else would you have his name in the title of a movie?
No, I felt that for the longest time, and that did follow Selick for years. Like when promoting, say, Monkey Bone or James and the Giant's Peach, people still think those are Tim Burton movies. If people tell you, like, yeah, it's from the director of Nightmare Before Christmas, like, oh, I've never heard of this Tim Burton movie,
And I won't argue that he was more hands-on with this movie, but the co-director credit does feel like PR to me, because I think it's just a bullet point to say, like, oh, this time he's co-directing. It's not just his name on the title. Looking at what he did on the movie, it felt that he did not actually have the duties of an animated film co-director. And then seeing the true director's comments on Burton, he says things like, oh, my job was to interpret what Tim wants to do and make sure it matches his vision. So I feel like, yeah, normally if you're a co-director on an animated movie, you have your own scenes you're doing, you're, supervising animators and all that. Tim Burton feels like an executive producer on this movie and not a co-director. The director on this movie is very charitable about it. I'm sure he was happy for the opportunity. We'll talk more about him soon.
This takes me back to the Cars and other stuff we talked about, though. Actually, I think Cars is deservedly labeled as a John Lasseter film. I think he was that involved in it. But there's some other ones where John Lasseter's co-director, where I feel like he didn't want to not be a director on the film when he is more of an executive producer, which is a very important role. Well, some executive producers are people who get a paycheck and don't do anything, but there are other executive producers who are involved, but it's the director who handles, like, it is two different jobs in my understanding. We're both, we've never worked on a movie before, but executive producer seems different than a director, even a busy executive producer.
Absolutely. And, unfortunately, there's not a lot of stories out there. I did a lot of research, and I really can't find out how this movie was greenlit or how it, went into production. I honestly feel that the story is basically this was kind of always on the table, or there was always Tim Burton wanting to do another animated movie on the table, and he needed for, the time to be available and the resources to be available. And I think, Nightmare Before Christmas made it somewhat of a profit. It was a popular-ish movie, not as popular as, like, The Lion King the next summer or anything like that. And then James and the Giant Peach was kind of a flop, so I feel like that might have set him back a bit. But I honestly feel like, talking about my own cynical projections here, the merch that began to sell in the late 90s and early aughts for Nightmare Before Christmas was unavoidable. So that told them, at least, there's a demand for more of this. And going back to our Nightmare Before Christmas podcast, I was telling the story about how there was very little merch when that movie was new in America. And I remember in the year 2000 seeing a Jack Skellington t-shirt at a Suncoast and saying, they made this?
Yeah.
Not knowing what would happen, not knowing there'd be entire racks of merchandise at Hot Topics and Suncoast in the future for every character from the movie doing every possible thing. But it really picked up in the early aughts, and I think it signified the demand. And this could have come earlier if James and the Giant Peach had been successful.
Yeah, I had the feel when this happened in 2005. Definitely my feeling was that, and this came up in our Nightmare podcast, but that, it was... The movie came out in theaters, did okay. It always was a battle between Warner and Disney of who gets to have the next Tim Burton movie, because they always were in contention to get him. And up to this day, they're still battling over who gets to put out a Tim Burton movie. But then it came out on video and it did way better than they thought the next year, but they still didn't really profit off it. It did take them until we, the children of The Nightmare Before Christmas, got into our 20s that somebody realized you could sell a bunch of stuff featuring these characters. And yeah, that's why it's crazy to me that Disney, who were making, they would have seen all the sales figures from their new Nightmare merch. They would have been the, should have been the ones who said, look, even if it's not a Nightmare Before Christmas sequel, if you have a new goth stop motion thing you want to do that we can definitely make a ton of t-shirts and toys out of, we want this. Like, and maybe it was a bidding war, I don't know, but
it also felt like Disney was really trying to figure itself out in the early aughts in terms of animation and what it wanted to do, deciding like what is the future of this company and our movies, and maybe that took up too much time to even consider another stop motion project like Nightmare 2 or whatever it could be.
I will say in the early aughts too, when this would have been greenlit, as I learned from the book Disney War, they were in a real mess at that point. They didn't know what they wanted to do with their animation. So I could also see that Michael Eisner or the guy or girl right below Michael Eisner who would have okayed this might have been just in a weird situation in like 2002 or three and didn't know what they wanted.
Yeah, California Adventure just opened.
Right,
it's not a great time.
Home on the Range is coming together and they're losing some faith in two dimensions.
So I was able to figure out that the trigger pulling for this movie happened during the end of Big Fish, and most of the production overlapped with Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which was mostly filmed in the UK. So Burton was available. He was within the country to like come in and check out production and everything. And of course, Johnny Depp was playing Willy Wonka by day and playing Victor by night in this movie.
I see. Well, you know, that Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, I didn't hate it, but I'll never rewatch it over watching Willy Wonka. Like
it sounds like the most poison movie because it's Johnny Depp playing Michael Jackson.
Yes, yeah. It was an insane choice to make back then, even then. And like I remember it was one of the first times Tim Burton really put his foot in his mouth about stuff because people asked like, hey, why are all the children white in this? And you could have had some child could have been a person of color. And he's like, it just didn't really fit. Or I don't want to make up what he said, but he pushed back against it and defended it. And, you know, it was a very 2004, three or four defense for things that you wouldn't have now.
Yeah, it's been almost 20 years, and with Corpse Bride in that movie, I feel like they would have made different choices for sure. But I do want to talk more about the production of the movie, specifically where Laika comes in, because as I mentioned before, it's an interesting time for them as an animation studio, because they signed the deal to do the work on Corpse Bride the day after forcing out Will Vinton. And
wow.
I believe, yes, they had an agenda here, and I believe I said on the previous Paranorman podcast that, oh, like, apparently they worked on Corpse Bride, but I can't find any evidence. Well, guess what, folks? It says, like, a Tim Burton Studios and Laika production at the beginning of the movie. So I goofed there because I hadn't seen it. But I think, honestly, if you're like, hey, name every Laika movie, 9 out of 10 people, or maybe like 49 out of 50 people, aren't going to say Corpse Bride because that element is on the screen in the beginning, of course, but it's not like a common fact, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and, you know, the story of Laika works so much better with it started with Coraline. Like, that's a much cleaner story that it starts there.
And even though Laika made it, obviously this was not shot in Portland or outside of Portland. It was filmed at 3 Mill Studio in West London. Again, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory was being filmed in and around London, so this made it so Tim Burton could jump between both sets.
Oh.
And he didn't want to be as removed as he was from Nightmare Before Christmas. So
yeah.
Basically, a bunch of people from Portland or the Portland area were picked up and then dropped off in London to work for 55 weeks on an animated movie, which is not a lot of time. I was looking at the timelines for some of the other stop motion stuff we did, and it's normally at least 18 months for production. I think Chicken Run was 18 months and Paranorman might have been longer, but a year is not that long. And honestly, this is kind of a lower budget animated movie. The animators do a great job, but the scope that we've seen in other stop motion stuff that we've covered isn't really in this movie.
You can feel the limitations watching it, not just in like the number of characters on screen, the tightness of shots. I think they are using their budget smartly in a lot of moments, but yeah, I mean, if you compare it just to like, you know, just to Nightmare Before Christmas, which everybody was going to do, nothing in it, like the big one big musical sequence in this can't approach This Is Halloween. Like,
yeah.
Alone.
Yeah, I mean, there aren't a ton of crowd scenes. There aren't a ton of like big set pieces, but they do more interesting things with just a few characters. There's a scene in this movie that honestly, I think like when I saw it, I thought, oh, please don't do this. And it's when Victor and Emily are doing a duet on the piano and they're hitting every key as if, you know, you were playing it in real life. And I thought, oh my God, this must have taken forever to do. But it's that instead of doing like huge chase scenes or huge like mobs, like in Paranorman, they're choosing like what interesting things can we do with only a few puppets on the screen.
Yeah, and they really do get to show off in some of those moments. Not everything in this looks as good, but there are some moments that I'm like, oh, that's impressive. That's very technically impressive. And yeah, I'm happy to hear that they, well, maybe it was tough moving to England for a year to make this movie, but the story on Nightmare was like he was in England, Burton was in England the whole time working on Batman Returns and barely could check in San Francisco on Nightmare. So I, you know, that at least sounds like he was, that lets him be much more involved day to day than before. I still wonder if he deserves a co-director credit on it though, but
I really don't think he does, yeah. But hey, yeah. The true director is not fighting back against this. So I think he's fine. So like with Coraline, they would kind of invent the 3D printing process for stop motion. I mean, 3D printing had existed, but they were using it to print out unique faces for characters that they would 3D model and then print out. They're not quite there with Corpse Bride. Instead of doing that, every one of the faces is full of like a bunch of little gears and paddles. And in order to manipulate the expressions, they basically stick a little Allen wrench in and turn it. So instead of having the replacement faces, there's just like the heads are full of clockwork machinery, and it does lend to smoother transitions between expressions and more subtle expressions. But I also think it does get rid of some of the fun jumpiness you would see on Nightmare with, you know, Jack Skellington's replacement heads and things like that.
Yeah, the part of the eeriness of Nightmare, especially with Skellington, is the popping between just saying any word, you know, you're popping between two different heads, and that's part of the eeriness of it. Though, yeah, Victor in design, I would say he, not in character, but he is Jack Skellington with skin. Like, he is the same skinny goth king, I guess I'd say.
Yeah, I was reading some quotes about the making of this movie, and it's funny because one of the people who worked on it, maybe the character designer we'll talk about later, he said, oh yeah, Tim Burton always designs these characters that are just impossible to move in stop motion. And that's the end of the quote. There's no like, and then we asked him to do revisions. It's like, no, we had to make these characters with spindly legs and tiny feet.
Yeah, you don't ask Tim Burton for revisions in 2005, no.
Yeah, and just to give some basic numbers as to the scope of the production, which again, it's a $30 million movie. I think in general, most stop motion movies cost like twice as much. It's still, you know, very involved. So there's 300 puppets for the 30 featured characters. Some cost as much as $30,000 each in terms of the amount of time it took to make them and the materials used. And for the main characters, there's a lot of puppets. There's like Corpse Bride has 14 puppets, Victor has 12, and there's like tons of stuff going on that we can talk about during the movie segment, like how they animated the Corpse Bride's veil in stop motion and how they often had to resort to like, let's just make it CGI in this scene. It's really hard to move it.
I wondered how much they went with CGI or not, because I'm still shocked Laika continues to exist in the stop motion way it does, because I would think especially back then they were just hearing in their ear like, look, just switch over. Same that DreamWorks was telling to Aardman back then as well, and they did it with Flushed Away.
Just to get it out before Ratatouille, basically. Mm-hmm. Just to have another rat movie rush to market. But in this one, it does feel like there's an emphasis more on making it a smoother style of animation, because I feel like there was a fear by the studio that kids love this CG crap now, and it's got to look like the CG crap, even though this movie is for people in their mid to late 20s who grew up with Nightmare, for sure.
Yeah. And
at least with the original release, at least.
And even 17-year-olds on like a first date. If you're asking out the goth girl in your class, this is perfect first date material. Mm-hmm. In the year 2005.
So we talked about Tim Burton. Let's talk about the true director of the film, Mike Johnson. So this should not shock you, but he actually got his start in the industry on The Nightmare Before Christmas, as I believe his title was rigging assistant and assistant animator. Oh. But he graduated from the Rhode Island School of Design, which I think in the industry you call RISD.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Ian Jones-Cordy, our pal, graduated from there, I believe.
And basically right from there to working on Nightmare Before Christmas. Although this guy, despite directing Corpse Bride, doesn't have that many credits, which surprised me. So I can go over a few of them. So he directed the stop motion music video for Primus's cover of The Devil Went Down to Georgia. It's a great little video.
Oh, yeah.
It's on YouTube. You can check it out there.
That's clever. Hey, that's also kind of like you can see it's like of a piece of Corpse Bride, at least with like the, you know, the metaphysical and the real world getting together.
Yeah, and the Will Vinton and Leica connection is the fact that Mike Johnson was a director on the PJs. Remember, the people making this movie were working on the PJs and, like, I think Gary and Mike and things like that.
Right, right. I always forget about that, the PJs. So one of these days we'll do a PJs episode of either What a Cartoon or Talking Simpsons. But yeah, I forget that's where Leica really got its start.
So yeah, he worked on Nightmare Before Christmas. He moved up to being an animator on James and the Giant Peach. After Corpse Bride, he was an animator for the short called What Do We Have in Our Pockets, and he was a guest animator for the film Anomalisa, which I have not seen yet. And it sounds like he mostly teaches these days, but his last big credit is a co-director credit on the 2017 Chinese CGI movie Ping Pong Rabbit. And you know, headhunting American directors to direct or co-direct these Chinese movies seems to be a recent trend, because I just went to a talk with Simpsons director David Silverman, and I forgot he co-directed or directed the 2021 Chinese CGI movie Extinct, and it's written by a bunch of Simpsons guys too.
I forgot all about that. That's right, man. Yeah, and there have been several of these, like, yeah, Chinese productions. It totally makes sense because, you know, the American-made films by so many of these people, they do well in China. They have a big audience there. And, you know, if you're a Chinese film company with lots of money, you're going to try to hire these guys. And, like, wait, well, let's cut out the middleman. Why are we buying, you know, a Paramount movie or whatever with all this kid stuff in it? Why don't we just hire the guys who make these things and then we own it? But there's always a, you know, it definitely seems like there's in the process something that's lost in translation, or at the very least they are not marketed well in America, whether they are good or not. You never hear about them in the United States, at least.
Yeah, I mean, movies like this are just a rectangle that appears on Netflix one day and you are like, what is this? Who made this? Is it good? Mm-hmm. I hear Extinct is pretty good, actually. I don't know about Ping Pong Rabbit, but yeah, it was a trend. And I think he mostly teaches, not a lot of credits, but the stuff he worked on is all solid gold for the most part.
That reminds me too of our pals on Michael and Us. They were talking about this Jackie Chan John Cena movie that just appeared out of nowhere, and it was like made like 6 years ago and then put on the shelf because at the time it was meant to focus on a project of connecting, you know, some Middle Eastern governments to China, and it was about a partnership deal, but then those partnerships kind of fell apart, and so they had to put it on a shelf and try to figure out a way to make it work. And it's just like, now for John Cena, it's China's favorite guy, John Cena. He loves China and China loves him.
It's always sad when your propaganda expires before release.
America's got that same problem. Though we have to get so vague in our propaganda now. I compare that with like Top Gun Maverick, a superb piece of propaganda. But they can't just say, oh, we're mad at Iran or whatever, or North Korea. They have to just be like, in the movie, they say, the enemy is doing this, and this justifies us flying planes into their country to blow something up. But they never name a country.
I think the first Top Gun was the same way, yes. Where they are just super vague about who the enemy is. But yeah, I agree. Like, make your propaganda, just make it up front. Don't lie to me.
See, that's the thing. If they make it too direct, they're like, well, can this really sell in China if we say this is North Korea? Or can this really be screened in Saudi Arabia if we say it's Iran? Well, actually, that probably would make it do better in Saudi Arabia if you say it's Iran. But the geopolitical complicatedness of it, wasn't there that news story of like Barbie was getting people mad in the Philippines because it had a map in it? In general, if you put a map in something, it's going to piss off some country because maps are very political.
If you acknowledge a few select countries, one other country is going to get really steamed.
Yes. Yeah. And then you got to do a front-facing camera apology. But anyway, this has nothing to do with Corpse Bride.
So we normally don't, I mean, they're very important, but we normally don't talk about cinematographers when we talk about stop motion. But when doing research for this, I found the cinematographer was actually like very important in the look of the movie and like in the innovations in filming. And that guy is Pete Kozachik, who actually died the day I wrote my bio on him at 72. So wow. I was not surprised after writing the bio to have my wife send me a tweet with Pete Kozachik, 72, and he's posed with all the Corpse Bride figures. So yeah.
That's so kind of creepy. Yeah. Well, hey, as if he in his last moments was remembering Corpse Bride, he should remember, hey, we're all going to die someday. So, you know, like, relax about it. As Danny Elfman's best song in this movie expresses.
Maybe he's hanging out with Mr. Bone Jangles right now, but I'm sure he'd rather be with his family and living.
Probably.
Yes. So Pete Kozachik, he was also the director of photography on Nightmare Before Christmas and James and the Giant Peach, and would go on to fill the same role for Coraline. So he's part of all of the bigger stop motion movies, or let's say the only stop motion movies of this era. Right. But he was also visual effects supervisor on Monkey Bone, a movie you don't need to watch. But while doing that, he was experimenting with digital photography for stop motion in order to get the stop motion and live action elements to integrate better. But digital camera technology was not quite there at the time.
Right.
So it all kind of begins there in his head. And of course, the spoiler is this is the first digitally shot stop motion movie, period.
Right. You mentioned that a lot in our Paranorman one that I never really considered in the digital to film transfer that was happening back then, that like it removes seams. It doesn't like get rid of all the imperfections, and we love our imperfections. But if you can get rid of some of the seams, it can be used for good.
Yes, it makes it much easier to remove, you know, puppet ringings and cables and, you know, all the seams in the puppets' faces. If you watch Nightmare Before Christmas, it's very charming to see when all of the bats are flying at the screen, you can see every individual wire holding them up, because it was too hard to edit that out of a film, to make an optical effect to get rid of those. But that's kind of where this all starts. And I think they were going to shoot on film from the very beginning, and then someone at Warner Brothers are like, you're doing digital, right? And they're like, yeah, digital. Sure. So 6 weeks before production started, that's when everything changed. There was a digital solution that Warner Brothers approved of. And essentially, I won't go into extreme detail here because there's so many like photography blogs and animation articles that go into like the nitty gritty of all this you can read on your own. But essentially, Kozachik went with a digital camera that could best emulate 35 millimeter film. That was his goal with choosing the cameras for this movie.
Well, because digital was relatively new on a theatrical level back then. Around the same time was the 28 Days Later film, which looks hideous today. It's still, I think it's a great movie, but it looks hideous.
But I think like Attack of the Clones was the first digital movie period.
Yeah. And the first fully digital DVD, as we learned from the Yoda Man commercial.
Yes. Well, there's a huge asterisk next to that, though, because it's like live action and all these other, because we covered the movie last year, but Rescuers Down Under, first digital movie, period.
That's right. Which everybody overlooks. They didn't even get the special technical Oscar that went to Beauty and the Beast the next year. Like, real dick move, Academy.
So this movie was completely shot and edited with consumer grade products. So it was, you know, done with digital cameras. It was the first movie edited with Apple Final Cut Pro.
Oh.
And yeah, like we said earlier, digital shots allow, you know, the special effects people to go in later and remove all the elements that the audience shouldn't see. That, you know, that help the animators move the puppets, but, you know, that make the audience aware, like, these are puppets with seams and gears and holes in their head, and we don't need to be seeing these when we're trying to tell our story.
You're right. Cinematographers, I mean, they're always important on anything. Even on 2D cell animation, you need somebody who's good at photographing cells to make it all look correctly. But yeah, where the camera is placed and how it films something, like, that's the equivalent of, like, the person who does the finishing on the pencil line work in 2D. Like, cinematographer matters quite a lot.
And the digital cameras were smaller, so they can get, like, closer to the puppets. There's so many other advantages. You know, the animators could see their work instantly instead of waiting for dailies to come in. It's important to get that instant feedback when you're doing stop motion, because it's very hard to start a scene over again. I mean, the old ways involve so much more planning, and I'm sure this did as well, but you could always be reassured that you're on the right track to get to where you need to get in the scene as you're seeing every frame that you're shooting in front of you.
Right.
So, yes, like we said, they were able to add a lot of effects in a much easier way. And the studio who did the effects for this movie was called London's Moving Picture Company. They won the Annie that year for Curse of the Were-Rabbit.
Oh,
yes.
See.
So they also did special effects for Curse of the Were-Rabbit, and they won for that. So
Twice
this movie was finished by Curse of the Were-Rabbit. It's a better movie, but I'm just saying.
It's so funny they're up against each other, because they are both, like, you know, kids horror and also extremely British, though. One is Americans, well, not all Americans, but up top, it's Americans doing like British drag, basically, and doing like, this is what we think of you guys, Brits. And then the other is British people talking about their culture instead of just goofing on it and saying like, oh, aren't you all like gray and eat sardines out of tin cans? And you're just a bunch of like class obsessed assholes.
And you all have scoliosis. Everyone in this movie has a hunchback.
Except for Victor and Victoria, the only people. Yeah.
Ramrod straight. Yeah, and not to compare the movies too much, but it's weird that, I mean, I love Were-Rabbit. I assume that Tim Burton's brand was a little stronger than the Aardman brand, but Were-Rabbit made a lot more money than this.
Yeah, that's fair.
Maybe it was that whole corpse thing in the title that drove people away.
I think it did turn people off. I think it was too gross for some people. They'll just have like, nah, this is like literally a zombie. And they were too early on the zombie craze, you know. A couple of years later would be The Walking Dead would be a big hit.
Yeah, I think it was just getting started. And,
oh, yeah, Shaun the Dead's the next year, right? And that's it was the year before in 04, wasn't it? Yeah, so and that's also British zombies. Man, the Brits were beating us on the zombie thing, first off. We were too behind them.
Let's talk about the screenwriters now. There's three of them attached to this movie, and the first is John August, who made his feature film debut in 1999 with the movie Go, which is very fun. I recommend that movie. It goes down smooth, just like Wade Boggs. And I want to tell you the Tim Burton scripts he wrote later. So John August, Big Fish, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Frankenweenie, and story for Dark Shadows. Dark Shadows. What?
Oh, yes,
what was I saying before? I don't know, but it's Dark Shadows.
I think you said it in a British style.
Dark Shadows.
Yeah, but no, that's, those are good. Maybe after this, Frankenweenie's the next one. We do the stop motion Burton one.
But I think after Go, he was just like a hot new writer that he was just thrown onto projects. So not everything he made was good. So he was a co-writer on a movie I just saw and don't recommend, Titan AE. I'm going to guarantee this to you folks. We probably won't cover this because I just found it excruciating. But the other writers on this, on that movie are Joss Whedon and Ben Edlund, the creator of The Tick.
That's why I watched it back then. I haven't watched it since it came out on DVD.
Now, we're going to do this now, Henry. We need to talk about your 4-star review of Titan AE on Letterboxd because this could break apart the entire organization.
To be honest, I barely remember it now. I think if I gave it 4 stars, it would be because I thought, like, well, it's ambitious and cool, and you didn't have sci-fi films like that back then. That's how I remember it, but I am really fuzzy on that movie. So please don't take that 4-star. I will probably re-rate it if I ever watch it again.
So now other movies he worked on. He was a writer on both Charlie's Angels movies, the live-action Aladdin, and he's currently attached as screenwriter to another movie that shouldn't exist, the Wizard of Oz movie Toto, which finally tells the story from the dog's point of view.
What? What?
Yeah.
I did not know this movie existed. Jesus.
It's based on a book, I guess, and maybe it's okay, but it's just like, it's just having more fun with the IP. They ruined Sam Raimi with Oz. Let's see if we can ruin someone else with Oz.
Again, it's like, well, I guess we'll see how that Wicked movie or movies do, because Wicked is being released as 2 films. We'll see if maybe that brings back up Oz fever, but it feels just like there's a new Jungle Book or a new Ben-Hur every like few years, and it just feels like, I don't know, that's for old people. Like we're not young, but we're not into Oz. Like it's not really something people go to the movies to see.
Yes, I do not care about anything Oz. I'll watch the first movie. It's great. I mean, sorry, not the first. I know it's not the first Oz adaptation. I'll watch the good one, okay? That's all I'm saying. I'll watch the good one.
The one where Judy Garland was tortured every day on set.
Yeah, everyone was tortured. Yes, the dog was tortured. Moving on, Caroline Thompson, we talked about her on Nightmare Before Christmas. She essentially filled in the gaps in Danny Elfman's little opera about himself. And of course, she started writing with Burton on Burton stuff with Edward Scissorhands. She's the sole screenwriter. Great, fantastic, amazing movie. Watch it this holiday season with someone you love. And she's also co-writer on the first Addams Family movie, as well as Homeward Bound, The Incredible Journey. That's the remake of the 60s Homeward Bound movie. And she also wrote the adaptation of The Secret Garden.
Yeah, you know, I really like that mid-90s adaptation of Secret Garden. I like that in general as a kid, though I think I never actually read it as a kid. I just watched multiple adaptations, but I just like, oh, it's cool. It's a secret garden. There's family secrets going around. There's a boy who thinks that he can't do anything and he has to be like in a wheelchair all the time. And then she convinces him like, no, you're stronger than you think. Like, I always like you're stronger than you think stories. Like, those are some of my favorite of kids' stories. So that's cool.
She adapted that. And then she wrote and directed two movies in the 90s. First, Black Beauty, an adaptation of that classic book. And also the movie Buddy, which, in case you don't remember, is a giant gorilla movie that's not Ed or Dunstan Checks In. It's one of the many big monkey movies of the 90s.
Buddy is the haziest one I can think of. I feel like I can envision Buddy here. Unlike Dunstan, Buddy isn't an actual ape. It's a robot ape, right?
It's a puppet. Yeah.
I'm just like Roddy McStew in Freakazoid trying to figure out who's the real gorilla and what's not in Congo.
And then in recent years, she co-wrote Welcome to Marwen with Robert Zemeckis. So I don't get it. I don't understand. You know, it's like, I feel like I heard the blank check about it and I still refuse to believe the movie's real.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it doesn't feel real to me. It's also funny that, like, my main takeaway, I think, from the blank check on it was that Robert Zemeckis is a big-time wife guy who likes to film his wife in, like, topless scenes in movies. You know, hey, if that makes their relationship work, more power to him.
Yeah, I guess he married a burlesque dancer, so that's he's found a place for her in his movies. And then third screenwriter on this movie, Pamela Petler, who mostly wrote here and there for unremarkable sitcoms like Charles in Charge and Saved by the Bell, The New Class, and a lot of others not worth mentioning, but she was a co-executive writer and producer on the Clueless TV show, which I remember being pretty good. I did watch a bit of that.
You know, I missed that one, but that's it. I'm also interested that there's two women credited writers on this movie too. Like that still was pretty rare back in the mid aughts.
And after this, she co-wrote Monster House with Dan Harmon and Rob Schraub. That was their first big break in Hollywood. And then she wrote a movie that I've never heard of, but then I threw it out there on Twitter. I was like, has anyone ever heard of this movie? And then everyone was like, I saw the movie. I was there day one. The movie is a 2009 CGI film called Nine. And Tim Burton is a producer. Some music is by Danny Elfman. It didn't lose money. She is, I think, yeah, the writer on that movie. And no idea what this is. Looks like a sack boy, but he's more like sack man, I think.
He's more mature looking. No, I didn't see it either. When I saw your tweet of that, I didn't see it right when you posted it. I saw it like the next morning. I couldn't believe the number of replies you got to that. Like, that feels like the most replies you've ever gotten on something lately. That also wasn't, you know, I don't think you've ever been ratioed, Bob, and this wasn't even a ratio, but I was like, wow, 80 people replied to Bob to say I don't remember this movie either, or hey, I saw it and I think it's good.
Most people were like, I remember the Coheed and Cambria trailer, and I think that's like Where the Wild Things Are, where no one actually saw that movie but they just remember, oh, that trailer, oh, so good. Yes, I like the Arcade Fire song, but I don't know anything about that movie with James Gandolfini, right?
Yeah, no, I barely remember it either, despite the fact that that was, like, for real my favorite kid's book growing up. I read it 8 million times. Is it because the main character's name is Max? Yes, of course it is. I was like, oh, that's the same name as me. Just like in the Goofyverse. Yeah.
As good as Goof Troop, Where the Wild Things Are. And yeah, we don't need to talk about Danny Elfman. You know who he is. And if not, I think you hit your head and you need medical attention, because have you seen a movie in the past 40 years? One out of every 10 has a Danny Elfman soundtrack, I think, at this point.
It's not John Williams, and it's not
Hans Zimmer,
and yeah. When I say Hans Zimmer in quotes there, then it's Danny Elfman.